Next week, confirmation hearings are scheduled to begin for Judge Amy Coney Barrett to join the Supreme Court of the United States. And I will bet you my medical license, I'm being serious, that there will be questions about, you know.
What could Amy Coney Barrett's addition to the court mean for Obamacare?
Healthcare, abortion, gun rights.
What does her judicial record tell us about the kind of U.S. Supreme Court justice she would be?
Judicial philosophy, maybe a little religion sprinkled in for good measure.
One of the things I want to ask her is, will she recuse herself?
The election, obviously, hot topic.
Court justice, so close to a presidential election.
But here's what I want to know. Will there be questions about science? And when I say science, I'm talking about the data-driven, jargon-laden, peer-reviewed wonder that is modern scientific research. Because as it turns out, the Supreme Court, and really all courts, have to make sense of science all the time.
Science is ever more pervasive in the courts. We're not going to be able to escape it. What we've got to learn is how best to deal with it.
And yet,
most judges are not really trained in terms of the scientific process or in terms of science itself. And that's where it gets really tricky.
This week on the show, science in the court. We're talking to a lawyer. We're talking to a judge.
You know, the two people you need to start any party, because that's how we roll.
From GBH and PRX, this is Nova Now. I'm Alok Patel.
Support for Nova Now comes from the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, dedicated to providing compassionate care and cancer specialists who are experienced in the cancer you have. When you hear the word cancer, their team is ready. Learn more at massgeneral.org/cancer.
So there are 1,000 things that I personally, outside of this podcast, want to talk to you about when it comes to science in the courts. But before we dive into it, could I just have you tell all of our listeners who you are and what you do?
Hi, I'm Jed Rakoff. I'm a federal judge. I sit in Manhattan, and I've got the best job in the world.
I'm all of a sudden nervous. I'm going to make sure I don't talk about any of my misdemeanors on this podcast.
Well, this is why we have the Fifth Amendment, for your protection. So.
Truth. Now, you know, Judge Rakoff, you were appointed to be a federal judge by Bill Clinton in 95, and then approved by the U.S. Senate to join the Southern District of New York. During this entire process, did anyone ask you about your ability to understand and interpret scientific research? Was there anything you had to say, like, here's my qualifications to be able to read science and make sure the truth is out there?
No, there was not. And I don't believe there is for any judge who's been appointed subsequently to be. That's not a question that Congress really has focused on, nor the people who are involved in the selection of judges. I think because, frankly, they're somewhat ignorant of how important a role this plays in the judicial system.
Even though Judge Rakoff does not have a science background, he's made it his business to educate himself on the subject.
So now I pretend to be the science judge.
He's even teaching a course this semester at Columbia, appropriately called Science and the Courts. And he walked me through just a few of the many areas where they intersect.
The Supreme Court determined that no one below the age of 18 could be sentenced to the death penalty.
Take the death penalty.
And they relied in part on studies that show how the brain develops.
Or abortion.
Roe v. Wade has a lot of science in it.
Then there is healthcare policy, medical liability, genetic engineering.
I have a case which I'm involved in right now involving a pesticide.
Environmental law.
Relative to climate change.
Criminal law.
Some of the most questionable science is forensic science other than DNA.
Not to mention anything to do with technology and computers.
Copyright law, patent law.
All these cases involve science.
Science has come ever more into the courts in a whole bunch of areas.
Now, in a lot of these cases, a judge's decision will hinge on some legal technicality that has nothing to do with the science itself, like the limits of a government agency's authority,
or the interpretation of some statute or legal precedent. But sometimes, that decision is informed by scientific evidence, and the stakes for getting that science right are huge. As a country, we've learned this lesson the hard way.
Judge Rakoff, I'm wondering if you can kind of take us back in time and we can chat a little bit about how the relationship between science and the Supreme Court has changed over the years, possibly mention any landmark cases.
Yeah, I think there are two landmark cases, and they show the difference between then and now.
Rewind to the roaring 1920s.
The prevailing federal rule for dealing with scientific evidence was to determine whether it was generally accepted in the scientific community.
That means there was no rigorous scientific process for deciding what kinds of evidence could be used in court. All you had to do was show that the concept or technique in question had, quote, general acceptance in the particular field in which it belongs.
This was known as the Frye test.
F-R-Y-E, Frye.
It was a 1923 decision of the D.C. Circuit, but it was accepted very quickly by the Supreme Court.
The problem with the Frye test is that what's generally accepted is not always right.
And that led to a lot of bad science coming into the courts. And the most infamous case was the case of Buck v. Bell in the late 20s.
Carrie Buck is a feeble-minded white woman who is committed to the state colony above mentioned in due form.
This was an opinion by no less than Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr.
She is the daughter of a feeble-minded mother in the same institution.
Holmes is kind of a big deal, by the way. He makes a lot of top 10 lists for most important judges in U.S. history. No big deal. Anyway.
An act of Virginia approved March 20, 1924, recites that the health of the patient...
And the question was, in effect, is it all right to sterilize a woman against her will, which, by the way, was done in the United States to the tune of 40,000 women, if the science, so-called, of eugenics shows that they will have feeble-minded, that was the term used, feeble-minded children. Now, as you might expect, it was southern states in particular that bought into this legislation, and they used it primarily against persons of color. This was science that had never really been the subject of really hard evaluation by scientists, but it was widely believed at the time.
So eugenics, the idea that you could improve the human race by weeding out the undesirables, was actually generally accepted. That's not to say eugenics was universally accepted. There were critics of eugenics in 1927, including some who called out the sloppy scientific methods that went into research on the subject. And yet,
when it came up to the Supreme Court on the issue of whether it was constitutional to sterilize a woman against her will, because the Frye test was the prevailing test, and because the courts did not look hard at science in those days, the Supreme Court said, oh yeah, this is fine. And they approved sterilization by an almost unanimous court. I think it was 8-1.
Yep, it was 8-1.
You know, Oliver Wendell Holmes unquestionably was a great justice, but we all make mistakes. This is generally regarded as his single worst opinion.
It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind.
And it wasn't until a fellow named Adolf Hitler said, Yes, eugenics is great.
An evil fellow.
Indeed. And he used it from early in his political career to justify his views of Jews, of gypsies, of homosexuals, and so forth, all of whom suffered, in his view, from eugenically proven defects that were inherited. And then, thank God, the scientists began taking a harder look at it, and the courts began taking a harder look.
We'll hear argument now, number 92-102, William Dalbert versus Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals, Inc.
The other important case, though, was, if I remember correctly, around 1993 or so, and it was called Dalbert.
Jason Dalbert was born missing a part of his right arm and lacking three fingers on one of his hands.
In Dalbert, the issue was a drug called Benedictine prescribed to women often during pregnancy.
Had taken Benedictine during the first 2 months of their pregnancy.
The Dalbert family sued the pharmaceutical company, claiming that this drug caused birth defects in their children.
And important scientists in their field.
The case depended on a new scientific study, but a district court determined that that study wasn't admissible because it didn't match the Frye standard of being generally accepted.
As we take the case, it's either Frye applies or it doesn't.
Long story short, this was the case that caused the Supreme Court to take a step back and decide it was time to overhaul the way the federal courts think about science.
The Supreme Court said, we are concerned that too much junk science is coming into the legal system, and we are going to put a new test in place, and we are going to put a greater burden on district judges to separate good science from bad science. And they devised factors that they thought judges should look at before they admitted scientific evidence. These were factors that were brought to their attention by the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
There were five factors in all.
And the first one was whether the science had been tested. The second was whether it had been peer-reviewed, particularly in publications. The third was whether it had a known error rate, and if so, was the error rate too great?
The fourth is kind of technical. Basically asks if the science in question has standards in place that control its operation. Don't worry if that sounded confusing, because the fifth factor should be familiar.
Still, whether it was generally accepted. So it was a much more refined approach than had been true under the Frye test.
And by a vote of 7-2, the court overturned Frye and established this new standard. The impact of the Dalbert ruling has been felt throughout the entire federal court system, down through the appeals courts and district courts where most decisions are made. According to the American Bar Association, there are hundreds of what are called Dalbert motions filed every year, where one party in a trial challenges evidence or testimony presented by the other party. These motions have taken on everything from toxicology and pathology to physics and engineering, even long-standing forensic techniques like ballistics and fingerprint analysis. In each case, the judge must weigh the evidence using the five factors established in Dalbert.
There have been many Dalbert hearings since Dalbert came down, so it's been a real weapon. There was a dissent in Dalbert. The dissent came from Justice Rehnquist, who said, this is going to demand too much of judges. They're going to have to become mini scientists. That was right. But I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a good thing.
After the break, what does it actually look like when judges switch out the black robe for white coats and become mini scientists?
Maybe I don't understand the science of this, and perhaps like scientists can do everything.
We've got the story of a case decided this year in which scientific research was front and center.
And the factors that we presented actually ended up being the factors that were used by the Supreme Court.
Could you just tell us who you are and what you do?
Hi, I'm Steph Tai. I'm a professor at the University of Wisconsin. I study the sort of relationship between science and the law. And I also do a bunch of volunteer work representing scientists in courts.
Very cool. Now, I read in your bio that both of your parents were chemists. Can you tell us what that was like and how that possibly influenced your decision to learn more about the field?
It was just kind of expected. We went into chemistry, so I studied chemistry as an undergrad. I got a PhD in physical chemistry. My brother also majored in chemistry. We were just all chemists.
How did that background kind of lead you into law? Like, what was that transition about?
Well, it was weird. It was like I worked with Mario Molina, who ended up being a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry for finding the ozone hole, basically. As a result of that, I actually became really interested in the impacts of humans on the environment in ways that we didn't even expect would happen. And because of that, I actually realized that, you know, policymakers don't always listen to scientists, and I really should try to get some other background to help influence the world in terms of listening to scientists.
Basically, what Steph Tye does is work with scientists to help them submit their information or evidence to the court in what's called an amicus brief.
Amicus briefs are basically friend of the court briefs.
In a lot of cases, it's hard to know how much of an impact those briefs actually make. But recently, Steph worked on a brief that definitely made a difference in a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, this is an interesting case about whether or not water that was discharged was covered under the Clean Water Act.
Nine justices, legal counsel for the Hawaii Wildlife Fund and the County of Maui, squaring off over how West Maui dumps its wastewater.
If you know where millions of gallons of treated sewage are coming
County
from,
of Maui versus the Hawaii Wildlife Fund. The organization Earth Justice has called this the clean water case of the century.
So this was a story where environmental groups in Maui, it took like, I think, 10 years to get to the Supreme Court, had been arguing that Maui should be required to get a Clean Water Act permit in order to discharge their pollutants into the Pacific Ocean, which they weren't doing directly. They were just doing through the ground.
This is an important distinction.
And so there was a lot of contention about that.
The Clean Water Act is a 1972 federal law that regulates waste dumping into what's called navigable waters. Think oceans, lakes, and rivers. It does not cover waste that's simply dumped into the ground, which is what the County of Maui was doing.
The county asked to have permits for the discharge of the wastewater into deep injection wells. But
they were injecting treated wastewater into wells deep underground at a rate of about 4 million gallons per day. In 2012, a coalition of environmental and community groups sued the County of Maui, claiming that some of this waste was finding its way into the Pacific Ocean, where it was damaging coral reefs and marine life.
Causing harm to coral reefs.
The environmental groups ended up doing tracers.
A tracer is a chemical, like a dye or salt, that scientists can inject into groundwater to see where that groundwater ends up and how long it takes to get there.
To say, no, this is really connected into the ocean. And that is covered by the Clean Water Act, except the problem is whether or not that groundwater connection counted.
So this was the key question for the court. Does dumping into groundwater count as dumping into the ocean if that groundwater flows into the ocean? Because if it does count, then the Clean Water Act is in effect, and the federal government has more authority to regulate what goes into the ground.
And so that was what was going on in the background.
We'll hear argument first this morning in case 18-260, the County of Maui versus the Hawaii Wildlife Fund. Mr. Lin.
Oral arguments took place on November 6th, 2019.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this case is not about whether the releases from
the lawyers for the County of Maui went first and argued that discharge into groundwater does not count under the Clean Water Act because the law only regulates point source discharges, meaning a single point, like a pipe, from which pollution directly enters the waterway.
The text defines a point source as a discernible, confined, and discrete conveyance.
But the justices of the court were not satisfied with that reasoning. Here's an exchange with Justice Stephen Breyer.
The pipe is a discernible, confined, and...
What happens if you just take the pipe and you decide what we'll do is we're going to end the pipe 35 feet from the river or from the ocean or something? Now, you know perfectly well that it'll drip down into the ground and it'll be carried out into the navigable water. And your theory, that isn't covered.
In that scenario, Your Honor, the land is the conveyance, and that pollution would be regulated under the non-point source.
The conveyance is the groundwater that is underneath the land into which the pipe drips the pollutant.
Yes, Your Honor. If it seeps into the ground, then the groundwater is what's carrying and delivering the pollutants. Yeah. And that scenario would be regulated under the non-point source program.
But what we have is, I take it, an absolute roadmap for people who want to avoid the point source regulation. All we do is we just cut off the pipes or whatever 5 feet from the ocean or 5 feet from the navigable stream or 5 feet for, you see, you understand the problem. What I'm looking for in this case is what's a standard that will prevent evasion.
What Breyer is asking for is a legal standard, not just an answer to this one case, but a standard or test that can guide how all courts interpret the Clean Water Act. And this is important to keep in mind because the stakes of this case could go way beyond West Maui.
Mr. Henkin?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The Clean Water Act prohibits unpermitted...
The lawyers for the Hawaii Wildlife Fund went second. They basically argued that it doesn't matter how pollutants get into the ocean as long as they originate from a point source and wind up in a navigable waterway.
Rather, all that's required is that the pollutants be from a point source. The Act expressly...
But again, there was some skepticism. Here's Chief Justice John Roberts.
But the extreme issue on your side, what is the limiting principle? As far as I understand, once you get the pollutant into groundwater, I mean, groundwater goes into the ocean.
Roberts is looking for a standard, a place to draw the line between what counts and what doesn't. Because at the other extreme, if suddenly the Clean Water Act covers all water that eventually runs into the ocean, that'd basically be all the water on the planet. That's why the justices are pressing so hard for a standard or limiting principle for interpreting the law.
What limiting principle do you have to offer the court?
And this is where Steph Tai comes in.
In this case, a number of hydrological and water scientist societies wanted to explain how hydrology works to the court. And so I and some folks ended up being the drafters of a brief to provide that information.
The vast majority of groundwater is stored in aquifers.
The brief pretty much begins with Hydrology 101.
Groundwater flow through these aquifers varies based on hydraulic gradient and hydraulic.
It explained basically how water scientists determine whether or not some kind of output ends up connecting to a surface water or not.
Multiple scientific methods exist to estimate and empirically quantify.
And that can involve water tables and types of ground composition, a lot of like porosity and stuff like that. So it was really like an explanation of how that all works.
All leading to the conclusion that in this case,
because of the hydrological connection, a discharge of a pollutant to groundwater is the functional equivalent of a discharge into the navigable water.
That's the standard Steph and these scientists proposed for deciding what's covered under the Clean Water Act. Is dumping into groundwater the functional equivalent of a direct discharge into the ocean? If yes, then it's covered.
If it's regulated part under this, if it's the functional equivalent of a direct discharge.
But here's the cool part. If you listen to the oral arguments for this case, which I know you're going to, you start hearing that phrase.
Then it is the functional equivalent.
Functional equivalent.
This functional equivalent of a direct discharge.
Again and again.
We can certainly embrace functional equivalent.
What does functional equivalent mean?
Clearly, the brief that Steph Tai helped prepare made an impression. But would it make an actual impact on the ruling?
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
And in April 2020, the dramatic conclusion.
Supreme Court issued a major ruling this morning over wastewater on Maui.
A U.S. Supreme Court ruling today says Maui County must abide by the Federal Clean Water Act and no longer discharge polluted water into the ground. The county asked.
I was on my sabbatical, so I was kind of loafing around in bed, just, hey, sabbatical. And I saw something about the County of Maui getting decided and then looking through the test. And I was like, this is the test that we sent.
Not only did the court take the amicus brief into consideration, But by a vote of 6-3, they created a new test for enforcing the Clean Water Act based on the idea of functional equivalence. To back up the standard, the majority opinion lists a bunch of scientific factors for determining functional equivalence. For example, how far the pollutant travels through groundwater, how much time the travel takes, and what the ground is composed of. Sound familiar? It should. These are the exact factors that Steph and the water scientists described in their amicus brief.
And so this seemed to be a time in which the Supreme Court listened to the science and they actually developed their test based upon all the factors that are relevant in determining the connectivity between some random discharge and surface waters. And oh my God, they actually listened to this.
Since handing down that ruling, the Supreme Court has lost a member with the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And this month, it might just gain a new one. Now, as I said at the top, there's a lot of discussion now about what Judge Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation could mean for specific issues. But I asked both Judge Rakoff and Steph Tighe what this moment could mean for science in the courts in general.
Science is not ideological.
They said pretty much the same thing.
Kavanaugh in the Maui case looked at scientific evidence. You know, it's not just some kind of left-right political alignment. I think it is more complicated.
People can be very liberal or very conservative and still say when it comes to science, I'm just going to look at whether it's good science or bad science.
Here's the thing. Science doesn't care about religion, politics, or what your friends say on Facebook. It's all about evidence and how you interpret it. Any judge who is worthy of the black robe should be willing to weigh the facts regardless of their ideology. And for that very reason, the tools of science have a permanent home in the court. And they're going to be called on again and again to settle disputes on issues that affect our lives every single day. Because science is everywhere. Get used to it. Before I sign off, a quick shout out to the Science Nobel laureates. On Monday, a trio was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for the discovery of the hepatitis C virus. And on Tuesday, a physics prize was shared by three recipients for their work on black holes, including Andrea Ghez, who helped show the strongest evidence to date that a supermassive black hole is parked at the center of the Milky Way. Ghez has appeared in a couple of Nova documentaries, including Black Hole Apocalypse, which you can stream online or in the PBS video app right now. Yesterday, the chemistry prize went to two scientists who developed a method to edit any organism's genome using the gene technology CRISPR-Cas9. This included Jennifer Doudna, who was featured in Nova's documentary on CRISPR, Human Nature, which PBS Passport members can watch right now on the PBS video app. And if you're curious about CRISPR, we did a whole podcast on that topic last month. Check your feed. Now, on to the credits. Nova Now is a production of GBH and PRX. It's produced by Ian Koss, Ari Daniel, Jocelyn Gonzalez, Isabel Hibbard, Christina Monin, and Sandra Lopez Monsalve. Julia Court and Chris Schmidt are the co-executive producers of Nova. Dante Graves is director of audience development. Suki Bennett is senior digital editor. Robin Kasmer is science editor. Emma UK is research intern. And Nina Porzuki is managing producer of podcasts at GBH. Our theme music is by the legendary DJ Kid Koala. The amicus brief we discussed was co-authored by our guest Steph Tighe, along with Royal Gardner, Aaron Okuno, and Kathleen Gardner of Stetson University College of Law, and Christopher Greer of White & Case. And I'm Alok Patel. We'll be back in 2 weeks. In the meantime, if you happen to get into an argument in public, use the Daubert standard to weigh any evidence presented to you, then take a victory lap.